Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest today is Max Romy. Max is a watercolor artist and filmmaker from Anchorage. He's joined us before to tell us about his creative style of using watercolors in his films focusing on the outdoors. Storytelling using pictures instead of words was born from his life with dyslexia. The last time he visited us, in the fall of 2020, he was developing a six-chapter project called Trailbound Alaska. Although the project has changed and evolved, he has finished one part of the film series, The Journey from Seward to Eagle River. Another one of his films, If You Give a Beach a Bottle, is a story that took him many years to tell and is a finalist at this year's Banff Mountain Film Festival at the end of this month. Max will also give us a preview of his next project, which is very close to home. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. With me today is Max Romy. Max is a watercolor artist and an outdoor videographer, and he's becoming quite a regular on Outdoor Explorer. He always has some exciting projects that I'm interested in and that I think are really great for Alaska. And this is his third time on the show. So welcome back to the show, Max.
So glad to be here.
So let's kind of reintroduce you to everyone. Maybe people haven't heard you on the show before. I think you were on the show twice last year about the Alaska Long Trail. And then we talked about some of your creative projects, particularly at that time. I think we talked a lot about Trailbound Alaska, which we'll talk about some more today. But let's talk about how you got to Alaska and really how you got into what you're doing, which was really a product of having a different learning style in school.
Absolutely. Well, I feel like a lot of stories, at least that I hear of Alaskans, is not so much how you got to Alaska, it's how you got back to Alaska. So often it seems like somebody comes here on a visit, or they see something, or even they grew up here and then they left. And it always seems like a lot of these stories start with how they came back to Alaska. And I'm no different in that. I came here when I was 16, we moved up, ran for service high school, graduated, went to college, and then became a filmmaker and kind of took off around the world. I worked with a lot of outdoor brands, and I was a freelance filmmaker for about 3 years, traveling, about 100,000 miles in total, and just really just was able to have some amazing opportunities, the kind of stuff you would dream about, like traveling with like amazing athletes to places like the Azores or, Germany or Norway and France and Paris and all of these wild places for work. But all of that just kind of led me back to Alaska. It's funny. The more that I saw, the more I realized that there's nowhere like Alaska on Earth. And every single new place I visited was kind of a reminder of that. And so really like all of that just kind of led me right back home. And so right before the pandemic, in fact, I actually kind of quit that traveling lifestyle, that freelance filmmaking side of things, and returned right home to Alaska to focus on more local projects here at home, which is what I've been doing ever since. Mm-hmm.
So how do you break into filmmaking? I mean, this kid from Alaska, do you just make those connections with people, or you had a pretty, I guess, significant film, and you did a film on Mount Marathon a while back, right?
That's right. Yeah. I don't know if I call it significant. It was significant for me at the time. I think I was only 19 when I first filmed Mount Marathon, but filmmaking is definitely it's a very new thing to be able to do it at this level. You used to have hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment to make a film. It was very, very expensive. Film stock itself was so pricey. I mean, if you think how much it cost to develop a photo, developing film stock was just, tens of thousands of dollars just in what we could fit into an SD card today. So I'm very lucky to be alive right now, because as a digital filmmaker, you can capture almost anything, even with an iPhone. If you have a good enough story and you are persistent, organized, you could make a feature film on an iPhone without too much struggle. It's possible for anybody. And the stories out here haven't changed either. I mean, there are still amazing stories around us. And so filmmaking for me was a little bit of like an accidental journey. I grew up dyslexic. Well, I still am dyslexic, but like growing up, it was a little bit difficult. And dyslexia is, it means that I kind of have trouble reading and writing, and it's not anything wrong with my eyes. There's actually 20% of the population in the world is most likely dyslexic. It's a somewhat of a spectrum, I believe. And so I grew up very, very dyslexic. I really struggled with reading. I really struggled with writing. And it was really hard in middle school and elementary school and high school when everything is written in textbooks and you just can't comprehend it. Mm-hmm. You see the words, they go in and they kind of get mixed up before they like hit that, you know, they hit that comprehension side of things. So I'd be reading things 3, 4, 5 times to like try to get what somebody else might get in a single reading. So it really just kind of set me back on that.
Yeah. And dyslexia, I mean, does it becomes visible to everyone around you and yourself maybe about the time you start to learn to read? I mean, is it something that is from birth?
Dyslexia, it's not contagious, or anything like that. It's just kind of how your brain is wired, how I've heard it described. It really is something that, that makes a lot of people more creative. I know there's something that has to do with the left and the right side of the brains that are slightly different. Although to be honest, like another side effect is that you can't really do lefts and rights very easily. That's something I really struggle with, especially when people are like turn left here and I do, and it was wrong. often happens, but dyslexia is something that is just sort of to do with the wiring of your brain. Mm-hmm. And I used to think of it as such a disability. It's really tough in a world of writing to have that. It just feels like everything slows you down. And it can be really frustrating. It can make you kind of act out. And people could see this as young as 6 or 7. It really kind of starts to show when you do start to read, but it's always been there. It's just reading kind of like uncovers it a little bit. Yeah. And I remember that when I was young, my mom thought I could read. She was so excited about it because like I'd been struggling and I managed to read this entire chapter book. It turns out I just memorized it. I'd seen the pictures on the page and I'd memorized what the words were. So she could point to a page and I could read it to her. But when she pointed to an individual word, I could not because I had kind of figured out this way around it. And that's really a metaphor for like how a lot of dyslexics move forward. It makes you more creative. Reading and writing are sort of shut down for you. And then because of that, you kind of have to figure out these other ways of moving forward. So oftentimes dyslexics are much more artistic. They're much more creative. Walt Disney was a dyslexic. Harrison Ford was dyslexic. He learned all of his lines by listening to them on a tape recorder, which is far easier than reading. And so for me, I became an accidental filmmaker because dyslexia kind of shut down these storytelling paths for me as far as like writing and reading. I always dreamed of being an author for like children's books or writing long stories, but nobody could really see past the spelling mistakes. And so instead, I really turned to filmmaking, which doesn't need any words, and kind of you're able to capture all of those and you're able to share a really wild story without having to write a single word, maybe just the title, which often I do misspell. And so,
but you have an editor now, right?
Yes. Well, my wife does. She really has taken on that mantle in a big way. But so like kind of going into filmmaking was really an offshoot of dyslexia and also of the people that really were able to be there and help support this kind of dream of being able to tell these stories. Cause it's tough to be a filmmaker. It's so much more work than you'd ever think. Every single second of film that you see is usually about 3 to 4 hours of work in the background. So when you're watching a 30-minute film, that's hundreds and thousands of hours that kind of go into it.
And then you have to look at those hundreds and thousands of hours again, right? To kind of choose what you're going to use.
So exactly.
You might have like hundreds of hours and you just use an hour from that 100 hours.
Oh right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And just like little tiny snippets of like all of these little things, but it's really nothing that I expected to get into. It really kind of has been accidental in a big way. And I think one of the first times that I really felt this way was, at the Lusac Library. I think they had a showing of the Banff Mountain Film Festival. And I remember seeing that and just like we were going there before a cross country meet, and the night before, and I saw this like festival of these just unbelievable athletes doing wild stuff all over the world. And living in Alaska, we have the mountains, and it just felt like these films just got it. Mm-hmm. Like I remember seeing that and just feeling like I want to be part of this. I don't know whether it's as a, you know, as an athlete or like as a director or like whatever it is, I want to be part of this. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I reached out to the local kind of arts teacher at Service, Mr. Hinshaw, who like lent me one of the old cameras with the mini DV tapes. And then from there, it was kind of just like falling on my face again and again and again and again until I learned how to tell a story that was okay. And it's been a really wild journey all the way back.
Yeah. So were you doing illustrations before you were doing filmmaking, or did that come afterwards? Because you do these just amazing, beautiful watercolors.
Yeah, that was definitely a part of the growing up dyslexic as well. My grandmother's a really amazing watercolor artist and traveler. And watercolors have been a really great crutch that have turned into just something so much more. You can't misspell a painting, which mm-hmm. is amazing. And so for me, sketching has been a way to be able to get my ideas down on paper. When I take notes, they just don't. It's just like I'm scribbling lines, basically. Yeah. And so for me, sketching and painting and visual arts have been a real lifeline to be able to kind of getting these stories and everything out. I think I would have been so frustrated as a young kid, especially not being able to express myself or share feelings, and art and arts have really just kind of given me a voice. Mm-hmm. And I'm just now really seeing the fruits of that in a much bigger way. I'm able to make the films and the visuals that I wish I could have seen as a kid.
Oh, that's great, man. That's the dream. You're living the dream.
It's true. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is definitely. And then, I mean, a big part of that too is, it is just like the community support. Like I'm really realizing that none of this is possible without a community that supports arts and artists. And I think Alaska is possibly the best example of that I've ever felt.
Mm-hmm. And we're kind of forgotten up here. We're still forgotten after all these years. Like we're, you know, out here by ourselves, but we've created this amazing community and these amazing arts and different people coming from here that are making a real impact on the rest of the world. So it's really exciting to see, I think.
I would agree, but I don't think we're forgotten. I think Alaska supports arts in a way that is totally different than anywhere else. Austin has country music and New York has Broadway and California is Hollywood, but like Alaskan artists have Alaska. Mm-hmm. And it's in everything that we do. It saturates the art up here. And I think the artists are able to kind of create and share that inspiration like nowhere else. And I feel like I'm just kind of dipping a toe into it. And there's people that have been doing this forever. Not to mention the people that have been doing this for the last 10,000 years.
Right. Exactly.
And I feel like the world just hasn't realized it yet.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe part of the art scene up here too is this kind of unique connection to the outdoors. Like so much of our art is around the outdoors, you know, even thinking about the people who have been here for 10,000 years and what we think of as their art now, the clothing they wore. And now even, you know, think about cuspix and everything, they've become a form of art, not just clothing, but a form of art that's really kind of unique to us.
Oh yeah. I mean, I can't speak too much to that. You know, that's tradition and the arts up here have really, like, you know, they've laid the groundwork for so much tradition and connection. And I think that we're just kind of scratching the surface of that connection to this place. I mean, I feel like community feeds creativity in a lot of ways, and that creativity kind of helps find the inspiration, and then inspiration helps connect that community. Mm-hmm. I really do feel like it's sort of the cycle that really turns. And in Alaska in particular, you have this amazing community that supports the outdoors and arts in this really interesting kind of connection. And it's something that I've certainly been inspired by. And I really do feel like we have a great support network up here as well, between grants and just individuals kind of looking out for each other. There's like this deep, like Alaskans take care of Alaskans, but I feel like Alaskans also take care of Alaskan artists. And it's been really cool to kind of see develop. And certainly something I never would be able to have done any of the filmmaking without that kind of support and help. Mm-hmm.
So last time we spoke, we talked a lot about, I think, Trailbound Alaska, which was this big project that you're still working on. And at that time, you called it your pandemic project. And at least that's what I have in my notes from last time. And you were kind of retracing history in search of lessons from Alaska's past. That's what I think maybe you had that on your website or something. So you were recently gracious enough to send me a private link to the one that is completed now. This one is completed, the one from Seward to Eagle River, right? That piece of it.
Yeah. So the loose idea was to kind of try to retrace some of these really long trails in Alaska, some that are forgotten, some that have kind of changed a little bit, and running from Seward to Eagle River through the historic Iditarod Trail was something that we tried to tackle last summer. And it really was pretty humbling in a big way. It is about 150 mile trail that existed long before, you know, Europeans ever arrived, but was kind of coined and blazed in about 1908. And since then, it was really kind of one of the main trails to kind of get into the interior, into Iditarod and beyond. And like a lot of trails, it had this really amazing history and then kind of just faded a little bit. And in fact, a lot of pieces of it are the Seward Highway. And so since then, Dan Seavey and a lot of the trailblazers and, you know, a huge amount of people have worked really hard to create a trail that people can walk on, not just drive, that connects these places. Still missing a few pieces. We gave it a shot. And there are some big pieces that need to be worked on. We're talking like type 3 fun. Type 1 is like where it's fun. Type 2 is where it's maybe a little bit rough, but like you still had fun. And type 3 is like where you don't really talk about it. And it takes a few months for it to kind of like fade in your memory before it becomes fun. There's a lot of type 3 fun out there.
Yeah.
But it's this amazing trail. It has this deep, deep history. And I think that one of the biggest lessons from trying to run pack raft hikes log along this was just how big of an impact community has on these trails and the effect of people traveling on these trails and kind of keeping them clear and well-maintained for hundreds of years, in the same way that people have followed a lot of these trails for thousands of years before, is really amazing to feel that connection. And also to feel like when it's been broken, it really shows you what was there and what could be there again.
What a couple of things that I thought about was when you took that detour over to Whittier, and then I can't remember, you ended up on some trail or old trail that Indigenous people had used to travel from. Am I getting this right? Maybe I'm getting it wrong.
Well, I mean, one of the big takeaways is that basically anything in Alaska was done before is something that I'm kind of getting the sense of. Any trail or road or path that we've been on Alaska has been done before, right, a very long time ago, you know, by someone else. It's just the difference is in how we travel it, maybe, and what the trail looks like, whether it was people following migration paths or a well-trodden trail to a road. There's these kind of lines in Alaska that have existed for millennia. And it's really interesting that it just kind of takes a little bit of scraping below the surface to kind of start to feel a little bit of this. And that's really what being home in Alaska feels like to me, is that like the more you kind of look and experience and live in Alaska, the deeper it gets. I don't know why anybody ever leaves, but
we all kind of leave for a little while and then realize, oh, what were we thinking? And we come back. Cause that
I'm really right hit, back. Yeah.
Yeah. That hit me when you said that in the opening, because, that's exactly was my journey too. Like, I didn't think I wanted to live here anymore. And then you go outside and you're like, no, I really miss Alaska.
Yeah. There's something about this place in a big way. And like, you know, I'm 27, so it's not like it's not like I have like a lot of experience to talk about. And I only moved here when I was 16, but, you're talking to people who have been here for 60, 70, you know, sometimes even 80 years, it doesn't really seem like they've filled up on Alaska either.
Right. A couple of weeks ago, and we're talking, so yesterday was, Indigenous Peoples Day. And so we're talking the day after Indigenous Peoples Day. So walking these trails the Indigenous people of Alaska walked is, I think this is good timing that we're talking about it today. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Aaron Leggett, and he's the chief of the Klutna tribe, the president of the Klutna tribe. And he also is the Indigenous cultures director at the museum. And he talked about, he's Dena'ina Athabascan, of course. And he talked about how the Dena'ina are the invisible people, and that's what they call themselves. And it is, you go down to like the Southwest and you see lots of reminders of the Indigenous culture down there, and, you know, hieroglyphics and things like that, you know, that you see, or ruins, old ruins, but you don't see that here. But what we do have from the Athabascan are these trails that they are the ones who put in, basically, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
I think so. Yeah. And I think Aaron would be much more qualified to talk of those things. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm very much the recipient, and the, you know, I've been able to benefit a lot from the work that a lot of people have laid down. I don't think we give nearly enough credit to the people who have come before in Alaska. And as someone who moved here when I was 16, I really think that history puts far too much of an emphasis on the gold rush, and mm-hmm. kind of starts Alaska around 1910, which is a shame, because yep. I do feel like, you know, people like Aaron have been amazing in sharing more of Alaska's true history, which is the thousands of years that came before 1910, and the thousands of years that will hopefully come after. And yeah, it really is. I mean, I'm not qualified in any way, shape, or form, aside from to say that, you know, being able to be on these trails and kind of to connect to the people who have come before in the smallest way, just by, you know, being on that trail and learning a little bit more, has been amazing. And I very much look forward to learning more from those people and who have shared and have made that history. Mm-hmm.
So when we talked about Trailbound Alaska last year, you were talking 6 chapters. So this is one of the chapters, is the Seward to Eagle River trek. But you had some other chapters that you were talking about. And I know that you've spent a lot of time with Carol Sepelu, because I think you were going to, or did you already do a short one on her, A Light in Nome, a short film on her?
Yes. So, yeah, well, I wonder how, like the chat, like I, just like a good hike, it kind of seems like a lot of well-laid plans go awry
yep.
in Alaska and are replaced by something you could never have predicted, but is often much better than you could have hoped for. Mm-hmm. And this is very much one of those cases where I think I laid out 6 chapters of a plan to kind of travel through Alaska on these trails, and almost from the start that has been derailed in the best possible ways. And has kind of helped me kind of connect with a lot of these trails in very different ways. So the original plan was to kind of go basically Anchorage to, you know, Nome from a connection of a lot of these trails. And so far we've gone from Seward to more or less Anchorage. And then last winter I traveled from Anchorage to Talkeetna, and then Talkeetna a portion of the way to Nome. And it's a, you know, lots of people do it by dog sled, snow machine. There's even the ITI, which is, you know, bike and foot and ski. So there's lots of, it's not exactly like anybody hasn't done this before. But the beauty of Alaska is that it's so big that every time somebody does it new, it kind of like is just another layer of this huge painting that is this really amazing state. So right now I am trying to factor in how some of that works and looks. And so last winter was Talkeetna to a portion of Nome. And a lot of that was thanks to the help of Carol Sapalu, who I've run with and filmed a little bit over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you two seem to have, at least from what I see on social media, this really amazing friendship. Like, it's very inspiring, your friendship is. You seem very connected through both running and telling a story. You know, her story is so important, and it's just, it's very inspiring to see your adventures together.
Definitely. I think creativity in the outdoors is something that gets overlooked so often. You have things that seem blatantly creative, like a person going outside and painting, or perhaps somebody writing a song about the mountains, or even playing a song on the mountains. It's just when people think of creativity and its kind of connection to the outdoors, that's like, there's some obvious examples, but I think it's so much deeper than that. And Carol's a great example. She has been able to use the outdoors creatively as a really incredible way to share her message, to you know, to kind of do some really amazing things in a big way. And she's much better at speaking to that than I'll ever be. but yeah, I mean, it's, creativity is so much more than just creating something inspired by the outdoors. It's really a way that people interact with these places. And I think that often arts are seen as something that is extra, maybe. If there's time after gym class and science and math, maybe you could do some arts, as if it's something that is just for fun. But I think in a lot of ways, arts and creativity is what gives us life in a big way, not just in the traditional senses. And I think that's something that I've been experiencing quite a lot of, is not only did arts really help me find my voice as a young dyslexic person wanting to share the wild and amazing things that I was discovering outdoors, they help a lot of people cope and find kind of passion and inspiration in a big way. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm just realizing a little bit of that. And I think there's a lot of big, scary things going on in Alaska in particular. I mean, whether it's wildfires or, you know, melting glaciers or things like Pebble Mine or polarization. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. And amid all of that, arts can seem so frivolous. But I think that they might be what really help us get through some really tough times, mm-hmm. in a big way. And community is what makes all of that possible. Mm-hmm. Not just from the way they financially support arts through grants and things like that, but you know, the reason we do arts is to be able to share it with that community, I think.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, the conversation with Max Romy will continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My conversation with filmmaker Max Romy continues. Well, speaking about melted glaciers, on this film, you used a 100-year-old map to trek through this area and try to connect these trails and everything. And that was one of the really dramatic pieces of it, was that all these glaciers had melted, and especially I think it was Raven Glacier up in Crow Pass, and how different it looked than what you saw on the map, like how much it had melted and exposed. So was that,
definitely.
It was that, I mean, that was your first time over Crow Pass, wasn't it, Nate?
It was, like, I had not actually made it to the glacier before.
Okay.
I had been toward Crow Pass many times, but the weather in Crow Pass is notoriously iffy. And so whether I'd been there and didn't quite make it to the top, or I'd been there and there's a giant cloud over it, I'd never actually seen this glacier. I'd only ever seen photos of it. And one of the main photos I'd seen was from 1911, I think. And it shows this massive glacier just descending right down toward Eagle River. And the map we were using was a printed copy of a map from 1910. So a lot of Alaska just has, a lot of it is very, very similar. Mm-hmm. A lot hasn't changed since about 1910, but a lot has. And one of the big things was the glaciers. Mm-hmm. You can see Byron Glacier and Portage Glacier connected and making it almost all the way to where the visitor center would be. A lot of the mountains just like end because they're in glacier, or that the surveyors couldn't get to the top to see what was actually beyond them. And so we were using a little bit of an outdated map that wasn't quite altogether accurate for how Alaska has changed. And so one of the biggest shocks was to get to the top of Crow Pass and to find what was essentially just like a missing piece of the puzzle. And actually, I take that back. It wasn't finding a missing piece of the puzzle. It was finding a piece of the puzzle missing. It's finishing the puzzle and seeing that there's a few pieces gone, like you got it at Valley Village or something. And there's just this valley that you could see that you could not see in the old photos in the map. Mm-hmm. And I'd known things had kind of disappeared a little bit, but it was absolute shock. And so I ended up staying there for about 4 days, just sketching this glacier and imagining how it would change or could change in the future. And at first, when you see these things, it's very depressing, whether it's, you know, climate change or, you know, like marine debris or something. A lot of these larger environmental phenomena are horrifyingly just gigantically depressing. It feels
we'll talk about that in your next film in a little bit too, because that's the feeling I had. It was very depressing.
Exactly. It's a rough thing. I mean, like when there's something that has kind of been set in motion maybe a century earlier and it's hitting you as an individual, it feels like the whole world is on your shoulders. You know, the polar bears are dying and the ice caps are melting and it's all on you. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot. And it kind of oftentimes is so hard to look at or scary to think of that I don't, and I just kind of push it out of my mind. And sometimes you can't when you're staring at a glacier that you think should have been four times the size. All of a sudden, it really, it does kind of stare you right in the face. And so what was really helpful for me was just sitting and sketching, even though a lot of that was in the rain and pretty miserable. but by painting this glacier, you really have time with it. Unlike just taking a photograph where you know, click a button, it's there, it's preserved, it's exactly there. When you sketch something, you are looking more than you're painting. So you're really just observing this giant chunk of ice for hours and hours, and you see these little subtle changes that you never would in a photo. You see like something, a little rock slide or something change, and you're literally watching the landscape kind of move around you. And instead of finding it more and more depressing the more time I spent there, I found that the more that I'm in these places that are experiencing this change, the more hopeful and grateful that I become. This has changed a lot. I would have loved to see this huge glacier back when it was miles longer, but I am able to see Raven Glacier now, and it's still really amazing. And in 100 years, it might not exist. You know, it might just keep on receding up the valley until it's gone. And that's a bummer. I would love to be able to show kids like, you know, the same wonder that I experienced, but I'm still able to experience it now and they might not be able to. And so to some extent, I feel super grateful to be able to see these places, know these places, be inspired by these places, and then have the opportunity to be able to share that now. Mm-hmm. And I think Raven Glacier is an amazing example of that. It's still there. Everyone should go check this place out. It's absolutely incredible. And it will continue to be so for, you know, about a century. But sometimes arts, for me at least, are the only way that I can process something so huge.
I thought it was pretty appropriate that you found a piece of debris in the glacier, which is sad too, but that it really, and I don't know if I want to give that away, if people should watch the film to see this, but it was like, I was like, whoa, he found this piece of debris that really connects to what you do.
Definitely. Yeah. Marine debris, there's a tie-in.
Exactly. Here we go.
I mean, it's like, I mean, on the side of environmental things, so it might seem totally disconnected, but another huge aspect of what I've been working on, let's see, hold on. Scoot all the way back here. So, I mean, like on the topic of just giant environmental things, like Alaska is such a huge geographic place and covers so much area, which is incredible, but is also really scary because there's a lot of change happening. So, shortly after experiencing this huge, kind of glacial moment, we were on a boat. So from like an environmental standpoint, I mean, there's so much of Alaska, that it can feel so overwhelming to kind of see some of these changes. And I think that's part of the reason why I traveled so much to start. You know, Alaska's so big, where would you start? It's a big place full of a lot of amazing stories and just like a lot happening, but a lot of it is huge. It's huge mountains, huge currents, huge everything. Mm-hmm. And it was so much easier to travel elsewhere and tell stories that seemed not quite so significant as the giant things going on at home. Mm-hmm. And so it might've been a little bit like, looking back on it, I think I might've been running away from some of these things in some ways, but now that I'm back and have a sketchbook in hand, I feel a little bit more prepared to share some of them. And one of the big ones was marine debris. It doesn't seem quite as connected to trails. Marine debris is basically ocean plastics that are washing up on Alaska's shores. It might not seem quite as pressing as like glaciers melting or the amount of wildfires we have, but plastics ending up on our shores is actually quite a huge deal.
I just have to say, it seemed like a big deal after watching your film. I mean, I had an idea of it because I've seen pictures and maybe some news stories about it, but watching your film and seeing how much plastic is on our shores and how we're catching all this plastic was just, it was horrifying. I'm saying everybody needs to see this film, but be prepared emotionally to, you know, kind of take a hit.
Yeah. To give a sense, like, marine debris is ocean plastics often washing up on beaches for the most part. Approximately 8 million tons of marine debris ends up in the ocean every single year. That is an unbelievable amount of marine debris. Like, I think a skyscraper weighs, you know, about 200 and something tons, maybe it's 2000 something tons. And 8 million tons is more plastic than you can really imagine. And that's ending up in the ocean every year. Some of it sinks, some of it floats, and a lot of it ends up on beaches. And the issue is, you might think, oh, it's plastic, you know, it'll just kind of get buried. But plastic doesn't break up, or it doesn't break down. Plastic breaks up. And so a lot of this is sitting on beaches, just slowly being ground down into smaller and smaller pieces. And I'm not saying we need to just like get rid of all plastic. We need plastic to survive, but and have the lifestyle we do,
right.
But the way we're treating it is not super appropriate, because a lot of this is ending up on these beaches and it's getting broken down. And when plastic gets broken down, it just kind of gets smaller and smaller, and it acts like sponges. It kind of picks up a lot of these chemicals. It might have chemicals in it already. And once it gets to a small enough point, then it kind of works its way back into the ecosystem. A bear swallowing a bottle is not going to be a huge deal. but the issue is then when the zooplankton and the small fish and the smelt and the fry start eating this, and it slowly kind of works its way higher and higher up into that ecosystem and sort of poisons the shore and the shore ecosystems from the ground up. And that's to some extent what we're starting to see now, is the amount of plastics in the everything, including people, is notable. We're seeing plastics in everything from fish to like newborn babies. It's really scary because it's nothing that we've seen before. Plastics are really quite new in a lot of this way. So, and the amount that we're using is a little bit horrifying. So Alaska in particular has a lot of these, and I was first introduced to it during a expedition to Kayak Island to volunteer to help clean up one of these sites where a lot of this plastic is washing up. Alaska's kind of the Aleutians are really on the edge of sort of the gyre. So there's this big spinning patch of garbage for the most part in the ocean. And it's almost as if you just put your hand into a washing machine with all of the, you know, all of that clothes would just get like stuck right on your hand. It's the same deal with a lot of these islands. They're kind of just sticking out into this gyre. And so you have these places that have not seen a person for the better part of a year, perhaps, totally remote. And they look like a dump. Just a full-on junkyard. It's a bit of an eyesore. Amazing stuff does wash up too. You'll find glass balls, sometimes like lifeboats, parts of planes. It's wild, but it doesn't make sense to find laundry baskets by the hundreds from Japan and from Korea, or plastic rings from Seattle on these beaches that no person has lived on for centuries. And it's concerning because to some extent, it's a ticking time bomb before it breaks down from this harsh Alaskan weather into something that will affect virtually every species in Alaska in a big way. Once you give it enough time, these things are all cyclical. And when you introduce something like plastic, it's just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. So seeing this was really rough. Understanding it was even rougher. And then when it comes to like thinking how you can make a change, it's absolutely overwhelming. And I totally understand it. I first saw Kayak Island about 5 years ago, and it took me about 5 years to actually start to be able to do anything and actually be able to start sharing about this because I didn't even know where to start. And so last year, I guess it was this last summer. Yeah. Wow. Time goes slowly here. Last summer, we headed back out to Katmai, Kodiak, and Afognak on another one of these cleanups where grants help some of these boats, which are, you know, retired like firefighting boats or crab boats, kind of go and pick up huge amounts of this marine debris. And so with a good crew, you can pick up almost a ton per day on these beaches. It's just making a dent in it, but you're picking up lines and nets and ropes and buoys and bottles. And you kind of can buy yourself some time and some of these ecosystems because you can pick it up now by hand, which is great. One hand could pick up, you know, 10 pound buoy or a 5 gallon bucket. But then if you waited 2 years, that 5 gallon bucket kind of disintegrates into 1,000 pieces or a styrofoam cooler. Easy to pick up now. You wait 10 years, that is millions of pieces of styrofoam, and you're never going to be able to touch that. So right now is kind of this really pivotal time to kind of buy ourselves some time. You can pick up the big stuff before it becomes really, really large amounts of small stuff. And so that's what they were doing. And so for me, art was a way to try to capture and share some of this in a way that wasn't uber depressing. and that's what I tried to do. And so I was able to, with a lot of help, create a short 5-minute film to kind of explain and share a little bit more about this issue. And with that film, I then submitted it to some film festivals and was like absolutely shocked when I found out that it made it into the Banff Mountain Film Festival, which is this huge film festival that goes all over the world. And was one of the things that I saw at the Lusac Library when I was in high school that really got me excited about getting into filmmaking.
I mean, isn't that crazy that circle just came all the way around?
Truly. Well, the funny thing for me is that I saw that in Alaska in high school. And I really felt that inspiration. And I thought that in order to be part of something so big, I was going to have to be somebody very different. Uh-huh. And so I had always wanted to be part of the Banff Mountain Film Festival. And so I followed famous athletes. I, you know, lobbied for huge budgets for some of these big videos, lots of travel to some wild places. But after all of that, what it really took to make it into Banff was returning home and getting a zero budget film that was created off of just like the help of volunteers, friends, and family off the ground. And that's what it took to reach those goals. I think that's basically Alaska in a nutshell, is like anything is possible here. Yeah. In a big way. And I think that extends not just to dreams of like getting into a big film festival or kind of being able to share stories in a visual way. I think that includes giant things like making a difference on these big issues, whether it's climate change or marine debris. Mm-hmm. Alaskans are really good problem solvers. And like, if dyslexia has taught me anything, it's that obstacles just make you more creative. And we've got a lot of obstacles as Alaskans. And I think we are outdoors creative people. And I think that's going to result in some really amazing solutions. So it's been a bit of a loopy trail to get here, but I think that for me, like creativity has unlocked a lot of doors, but I also think that, big problems are going to require some big solutions, and that creative people, and especially Alaskans, are going to be the ones who can imagine those solutions.
Mm-hmm. When is the premiere of the Banff Film Festival?
This is a whole new world for me. I've dreamed about being in Banff. I've never been in Banff. So.
Right, because you're going to go, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Banff, Canada is pretty beautiful. Like, you know, by Alaskan standards, it's like, you know, a slightly larger Klutna maybe, but it's been host to this like really, really big influential mountain film festival. So it's only a 5-minute film, but it made it in. So this October 31st, I think it is, maybe 30th. We're heading down to go check it out. It's a slightly smaller one this. Oh yeah. Very soon. Yeah.
Wow.
It's a slightly smaller one this year. Yeah. So it's a slightly smaller one, but it's going to be an amazing opportunity to basically go hobnob with some of these like big budget, fancy filmmakers, and hopefully learn a lot about what they did and kind of take some inspiration and return right back to Alaska. Because I think I've learned my lesson this time that you don't need to travel far to find the things that matter. I think it really was proof that.
And the difference that you have too, is that you don't have anybody raising these funds for you to get funds to make these films. You have to go out and find the money, right?
Right. That's the hardest part of filmmaking. Nobody tells you about is that you basically work for free forever. Mm-hmm. That's I think musicians know that too. It's definitely part of that arts thing, but I've been very lucky in that I've actually had quite a few grants to be able to support me on several of these projects. I mean, the Trailbound Alaska side was supported by the KMTA grant, which is the Kenai Mountains Turning in Arm. They do grants up to $15,000 to kind of support things in the area. They're amazing. There's a local Anchorage grant that was awarded, and then a few brands have helped out. And so it really is amazing the way that Alaskans can support you. I have some cards at like some local shops like AMH and Skinny Raven and send some out online. But it's not like Hollywood where you have these giant investors throwing huge amounts of money. But what we do have here is we have got like an amazing community that does support this really enthusiastically. In a way like nowhere else I've ever been or really seen. And so this is just really the first step. It's been a dream for a very long time, but it's also a 5-minute film. And so,
but it's a 5-minute film in Banff, which gives you more leverage on down the road.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. It really does. It really does help. And like, if I was to give any advice to filmmakers, it would be, I mean, one, just get started. There's, No one will ever pay you to do something. They'll pay you to repeat something. And so oftentimes you really have to take that first step yourself. And there's no better place or better time to start that right now. And I think with filmmaking and creative things especially, we kind of just, like I said, we see these as just extra. Maybe it's something worth extra.
Yeah.
But the other big part is that you don't have to be the artist, you don't have to be the musician or the painter to really make a difference. Supporting those people is a major deal. Whether you're a teacher or a parent or just a friend, the way that a community encourages and supports and really holds up its artists, I think is really important. Mm-hmm. And Alaska's been really, really amazing in the way that it's done that.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of hinting about, well, not really hinting, but you said the place you need to be was home to kind of work a lot of this stuff out. And there's lots of adventures and stories to tell here. So I know that you have some plans for this next winter that are very close to home. So yeah.
Well, I plan to lean in on that a little bit. I mean, just with so much travel kind of under my belt, it's really made me want to do a little bit of the opposite. I think that Alaska in particular is just a really, really beautiful, amazing place. And even at home, I kind of feel like I need to travel 3 hours to be able to see something new. But so often, if you just kind of turn your focus locally, you'll be able to discover something right out of your door. Mm-hmm. And so my plan is to do the opposite of the freelance thing, where you travel huge amounts of distances to take 1,000 photos of like one really quick moment. And so instead, my plan is to stay within an hour of Anchorage and capture places by staying there for a whole day, maybe 8 or 10 hours, and making a single painting. So really the opposite of that. And I'm very excited to see kind of what happens when you sit in one place and then watch the world turn around you. So the loose plan is to try to paint at freezing temperatures in Alaska with watercolor. I'm still trying to figure out how to keep the paint from freezing. The best thing that I've hit on right now is using like gin or moonshine instead of water, which evaporates instead of freezing instantly. So still a few kinks to be worked out. The other one is how like to make me not freeze. That's like the weakest link right now. But it's been a really cool experience to see the world change by just staying in one place, staying home, and kind of just opening your eyes to that.
Well, this is going to be a big departure, because you usually, when people see your films, I think you just have this really unusual technique that I think is just so cool, where you have this sketchbook and you watercolor in it what you're looking at, and then you hold the watercolor up to the view. So in the film, you're seeing both the watercolor and the actual what's out there. And so you just kind of fit it in there, and it's a very small watercolor. So this is going to be a huge, you're going to go really big on these, right? This is going to be a big change.
It's quite literally a big change. People don't see what artists see, I feel. Which is actually, when I say that, this seems kind of pretentious, but like people,
<That's okay. laughs> you can be pretentious.
Great. All right. I've got the pass. I mean, when somebody sees a piece of art in a gallery or a museum, they're just seeing like such a small piece of it. And frankly, the landscape does the heavy lifting as far as inspiration and, you know, and what actually matters. We're just seeing this little tiny snapshot. So even if it's a giant Sidney M. Lawrence painting, or, you know, a Duke Russell, or, you know, some of these really amazing photographs or paintings, like this is just this tiny little snapshot in the place. And I think that's what Alaska really has on a, you know, on a grand scale, is like the stuff that inspires this. And so for me, it's always been really fun to make the sketch in the place. And as the artist, you get to experience that whole world. And so what I'll often do is I'll paint, say, a picture of the mountain, and then I'll take the picture of the sketchbook in the mountain so they kind of line up. So you can see the sketch being this little tiny puzzle piece of this big, big picture. And so what I'm hoping to do is a little bit bigger of a scale of that. Although, to be honest, no amount of paper in the world will be able to capture the place that is just, you know, right in our backyard. But it's fun to try, that's for sure. And so very curious of really capturing that process. I'm also very aware that when it comes to filmmaking, disaster is super fun to watch. And so unfortunately, I think a lot of this is just going to be the struggle of trying to paint a 3-foot by 4-foot sheet of paper in negative temperatures using alcohol in somewhere that's freezing cold and miserable and windy. So I think unfortunately... So Yeah,
I have to admit that I did not connect. You're going to make a film of this.
Oh yes, sorry. I'm also going to capture this process. Yes, yeah.
Yes, no, I mean, yes. Oh, if, that's so cool. I did not connect that, but of course you are.
Right. Yeah. No. If the art doesn't turn out, at least you can become the art.
Yeah.
even if it sucks.
We want some drama, Max, but we don't want some drama too.
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, like I said, the landscape does the heavy lifting, and if it doesn't want to be painted, it won't be. Mm-hmm. But capturing that process, I think, will hopefully encourage others to kind of get out there. And I think if I'm able to do anything with the art is hopefully to pay it forward. And, you know, like the inspiration that I took as a kid from a lot of other artists when I was struggling with reading and writing, they really helped show me avenues out of that. And I don't know if any of these are specific avenues to kind of, I don't know if anybody should repeat trying to make a giant painting in the cold. My experiences so far have been like a lot of frost nip and cursing, but I'm really hoping that by following a lot of these paintings and kind of this connection between the landscape and art, it encourages and inspires other people to be able to kind of take that step that I was encouraged to about 15 years ago. And I'm also really excited to see the ways that art helps us navigate some of these really big problems that frankly could just use a little bit of creativity to kind of get unstuck.
So do you have any specific locations picked out yet, or do you want to keep those top secret?
Oh no, not top secret at all. I mean, they might change though. Like you really can't control anything out here.
Right.
Learning to be flexible is something that I am learning, but like, holy cow, like Alaska takes that to a whole new level. It's just kind of like, Oh, you wanted to paint on top of this mountain? How about a blizzard?
Yeah.
Loosely I was thinking the Turnagain Arm would be really amazing to kind of watch the tide come in. One thing I really want to do is to not paint the shortest day of the year. Everybody seems to like capture the solstice, the shortest day of the year. But I think what's so cool is it's actually the longest night of the year.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to go out, plunk myself down, build a studio out of snow and capture the largest night of the year, longest night of the year, by painting for, I think it's 14 or 15 hours. Wow. So really excited to see what that could look like. Maybe get some Northern Lights or just get totally socked in and just make a big blank canvas. Mm-hmm. But, very, very excited to see kind of that connection between the landscape and what happens when you try to capture it for better or for worse.
Well, Max, it's been great having you again. I'm really looking forward to talking about more projects in the future and finding out how this all works out. And thanks a lot for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for the opportunity. And I'm just really excited to be able to give back a little bit to a community that's really encouraged me so much. And I think this is just hopefully the first small step of a lot more like it. It's a big place and a lot of these problems aren't going anywhere, but neither are Alaskans.
Well, I think we're really lucky to have you. Thanks for coming home.
Yeah, right. Well, it's been a long time coming.
Yep. That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Max Romy. On alaskapublic.org, you can find pictures and a link to Max's website where you can view a trailer of If You Give a Beach a Bottle. Trailbound Alaska has not been released yet, but you can find a trailer of Max's chapter film concept on his website. You'll also find a link to the Banff Mountain Film Festival, where you can find information on how to virtually view the festival from October 30th to November 7th. Good luck to Max as he pursues the competition at Banff. The show is produced by Eric Borg. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.